I think the key is, I'm going to come back to saying again, the thing you want to do is to train as often as you can without getting injured. And that's the key, without getting injured. If you can avoid picking up an injury and getting sick, you're doing a really good job. And 90% of the benefit is going to come from just getting out there and doing the training and not getting in your own way.
The Triathlon Show, 158. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview coach Rob Wilby. Rob is a professional triathlon coach based in England, and he is the head coach at Team Oxygen Addict and also a podcast host of the popular Oxygen Addict Triathlon podcast, which many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with. And Rob's primary focus and specialty area is to help age groupers make the most out of their training time, especially those that focus on the half and full distance races and have a limited amount of training time to use. So we'll get into that, and that's the topic of today's interview. Just before that, I also want to quickly mention that Rob interviewed me for the Oxygen Addict podcast, so you can listen to that interview. It's already out, and it's episode 205 on Oxygen Addict. Before we get into the interview, this episode is sponsored by Stack, that you can find on stackzero.com. And I am now riding on the Stack Zero Halcyon, their new smart trainer model, and I have to say that I am really looking forward to spending some quality time on it over this winter. Last winter I was riding exclusively outdoors, and while it was fun, it was great, except for when it was raining, which it does rain sometime here in Portugal. I do think that with indoor training you can be really, really time effective, and that's something that I want to be more so this year than last year. Last year I was actually injured from running, so I had more time to spend, but this year I do not carry any injuries, touch wood, so I will have to be more effective with my time. Again, this falls nicely with today's interview, actually. And the Stack Zero Halcyon, that's a fantastic trainer for me to do that on. I've noticed that over my first few rides that I've done on it by the time of this recording, and I really look forward to getting more and more used to it and using all its functionality with the different apps that I'm also testing out, as you heard in the last episode. I'm testing quite a few of them now, including Zwift and Ruvi, both of which are completely new to me. So it's all good fun, and you can get a Stack Zero trainer, either the Halcyon or one of their more entry-level models without the smart trainer functionality. And whichever model you choose, you can get 20% off with the discount code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps, on stackzero.com. And big thank you to Roka, and welcome back as a sponsor, Roka. Roka can be found on roka.com, that's roka.com, and now they also have the UK and EU distribution, so no more import taxes or customs, other unnecessary fees. You can buy directly through uk.roka.com or eu.roka.com, or just navigate to those particular sites through the drop-down menu with the flags that you'll see on the main website as well. So great news for all the European and United Kingdom, so still is part of the EU and will be part of Europe for the foreseeable future, as far as I'm aware. But great news for all of us. And if you are looking for wetsuit, trisuit, swim equipment like neoprene shorts, buoyancy shorts, sunglasses, goggles, Roka carry all of these items and many more that are of the highest quality and really, really, really well researched and developed. They spend a lot of time and money on the research and development to make the products best in class. So definitely check them out. Might be something to give to your partner, family, friends for Christmas if they're looking for anything in those categories. You can get 20% off your purchase or your entire order with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps, on roka.com. All right, now let's get into Rob's interview and hear about his approach to effective winter training for time-crunched athletes. Today's guest on That Triathlon Show is Rob Willoughby from Oxygen Addict. Rob is a fellow coach and podcaster. I'm sure many of the listeners will be familiar with the Oxygen Addict podcast. So it's great to have you here, Rob.
Oh, Michael, thank you so much for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a long-time listener of the show, and it's quite an honor to be asked on, man. I'm quite excited about it.
Well, me too, and especially considering that the topic that we're going to talk about is one thing, something that is so relevant for almost all age group athletes, if not every single one of them, and that is time-effective training. And we talked about this many times before on the podcast, and I want to basically pick your brains on how you work in that time-effective framework for age group athletes, especially now heading into winter. So why don't you start with talking from an overall big picture perspective of how you maximize the effectiveness of your age group athletes' training time?
Yeah, cool. Well, it's funny that you mentioned the whole time angle of it, because over the years, I've been coaching triathlon now professionally for about 10 years. And it's one of those things where over time, you hone in on what works best for your athletes over the different seasons. And one of the recurring themes that I saw with a lot of the athletes that I coached, who, of course, 99% of them have got full-time jobs and families to work around, is they're super, super keen, but they don't have quite as much time to train as they would like. That's almost a given at any point, right? Everybody would like more time. And so the key thing is trying to make their training as effective as you can in the time that they've got. So over the years, I've come up with this framework for training, especially for age group athletes, and especially for those who are training for 70.3 or Ironman distance. And I called it the Time Training System, and the acronym TIME. It stands for all the things that I found were important in training, but it's named after time because that was like the one recurring angle in all of the athletes that I talked to that they really struggled with. So yeah, the most important thing is making sure that our athletes get the most bang for the buck that they can out of whatever training time they've got, you know, essentially whether that's limited training time or not.
So let's talk about that TIME acronym. What does it stand for?
Okay, so In a basic form, we go with T-I-M-E. The T stands for test and evaluate. So the first thing we want to make sure is that we evaluate the time that an athlete's got, and we say to them, like, honestly, how much time do you have to train? Let's really go into, be honest with yourself, because you're going to get so much more effective training if you're trying to do the training plan that's realistic and that's written for the amount of time that you've got, rather than going, well, I hope I've got 16 hours to train this week and I'll find that time somewhere. But actually, you know, they don't have that time in the first place. That's the first bit. Let's be honest in the evaluation. The second thing is that we want to test our athletes regularly in all the sports, because you can't afford to train with guesswork. If you're limited with the time, you really need to know exactly where you are so that you're not going to waste any of your limited training time, and make sure that the intensities that you're training at are always exactly the ones that are going to bring you the most improvement for the shortest amount of time. The I in the acronym stands for intensity, or better, the intelligent use of intensity. So by that, I mean, we're going to use the appropriate intensities in both swim, bike, and run at the appropriate times of year. And they're not always going to be the same. So depending on whether we're in winter, spring, or in the race preparation phase, it's going to make more sense to do some intensities at other times of year. The M stands for mindset. And that's super important, because I think the way that you approach your training and whether you've got confidence in what you're doing is so important. And I'm sure you've seen as a coach, it's the one thing that coaches can really help an athlete with, is that reassurance that the thing that you're doing is proven, it's not going to waste your time, and your athlete doesn't have to sit there reading through 6 or 8 hours worth of blogs and articles every week to try and convince themselves that what they're actually doing is going to be the most effective way of training. And then the E stands for effective effort. So that ties all of it together, really. It's sort of saying to people, look, we want to make sure that anything that you're doing in training is going to get you to your goal as quickly and as efficiently as possible.
So just to recap there for the listeners, that was test and evaluate. It's intelligent use of intensity. It's mindset, and it's effective. Sorry, what was that? Effective.
Effective effort. It's effort, but it's like effective use of effort is the key to it, really. Yeah.
Okay. So let's start with with the, well, I think the test and evaluate really, it's quite self-explanatory. We can go into the intensity part of it, I think that's, and, or actually before that, let's talk about what the training might look like, again, from a brief overview perspective, in the different phases of training, winter, spring, and race preparation for the 70.3 and Ironman athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that the key thing that guides all of this is this phrase, like, your goal is to be the fastest triathlete that you can be on race day. And all of your training should be aimed at that, making you cross from the start line to the finish line as fast as possible, not necessarily to be either the fastest swimmer or fastest biker or fastest runner you can be. And that's, it sounds kind of obvious to say it, but I think it gets lost in the wood for the trees angle sometimes, in that athletes get so focused on, like, I need to be a faster swimmer. Actually, sometimes we need to take a step back and go, you've got X number of hours a week to train. What's the best way to use those hours of training in order that you can be the best athlete you can be come race day? So it might not always be to do tons of swimming, even if you're a weak swimmer, just because of the nature of triathlon being, you know, you're going to spend much more time on your bike on race day than you are in the water. Okay, so my approach to winter training first, if we talk about that, the key thing that I look for in my athletes over winter is that we're going to use the majority of their time to focus on the thing that's going to make the biggest difference to their overall race time. And so for both 70.3 and iron distance races, I focus on improving their bike power. That's like the headline figure. We're going to do two or three short but high intensity workouts focusing on raising the functional threshold power. Or if your listeners aren't familiar with that, essentially it's how fast you can go over a 40 kilometer time trial, if you like. What's the maximum power you can put out for an hour? If we can raise that functional threshold power in our athletes, we can be pretty certain that they're going to be faster for any given distance for the same sort of relative effort. So in an ideal world, I want my athletes get into springtime, and when they go out for a ride with the mates after the long hard winter, all of a sudden the friends that they used to ride with can't keep up with them anymore. Because they've raised the functional threshold power in the winter, when they go outside for whatever was a perceived exertion of 5 out of 10, they're now going 2 or 3 kilometers an hour faster for that same sort of perception of effort. So that's my number one focus of use of our training time in winter, is those 2 or 3 focused bike sessions that they're going to do.
And what sort of intensity is, if we dig a little bit deeper into that, would those 2 or 3 bike sessions be ridden at?
Great. Yeah, because I love jumping into the detail of this. So what I'll have is typically the two key bike sessions of the week. I usually advise my guys to do them on a turbo trainer, because then we can control a lot of the variables. And within a 60-minute session, including a warm-up and a cool-down, we're going to look for somewhere between 30 and 40 minutes of hard work, including rests. And so we're going to be looking at working at or around 100% of functional threshold power. And we're going to be looking at working in a ratio of about 5 minutes of work to 1 minute of rest. Now, that's a very oversimplified version of this. So a classic session they might get might be 6 repetitions of 5 minutes working at 100% of threshold with a minute's recovery. And then, I mean, you can make the argument, you could have your athlete do that once a week for 16 weeks, and they're going to be a lot faster at the end of the winter than at the start. But we know that people are going to get bored, and we know that people are also going to need some progression. So we'll start them off with those chunks broken up into smaller chunks, and we'll build them across that duration of the winter into longer chunks. So by the end of that winter, they definitely feel as though they can hold that 100% for a longer period of time. And they're also, they're getting to the point where, okay, to give you a better example, at the start of the winter, I might have them do 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 2 minutes, 1 minute in a kind of little mini pyramid. That might be the introduction to the training at threshold. By the end of the winter, we might have them doing 4 sets of 8 minutes or even 3 sets of 10 minutes at 100% of threshold. So the overall amount of work that they're doing at threshold might not change that much across that duration of time, but the longer chunks that they're doing within it are definitely going to help them hold that 100% of threshold for a longer time across the duration.
Yeah. Okay. So, if we keep talking about the winter, spring, and race prep training, then let's talk about winter and wrap that up with the swim and the run training that you do.
So a lot of the surprise in athletes that come to me for coaching is they come to me and say, look, the weakness in my race is always my run. I really want to help you to improve my run performance. And they're expecting to get tons of hard work on the run. And the plan that I give them almost always involves only running at a steady intensity. And they look at me and kind of go, how's this going to make me a better runner come race day? And again, I say, look, we've got to go back to the bigger picture. You've got to be the fastest triathlete you can be on race day. And it's pretty much a given fact that the human body can only absorb so much threshold training in a given week. So if you look at a track runner, they might go out and do two threshold sessions a week on the track, and the rest of it's all steady running. If you look at a time trialist in cycling, again, they might do two or three sessions of threshold in a week, and then the rest of it's all steady riding. If you look at a swimmer, they might do two or three threshold sessions in a week, and then the rest of it's all steady swimming. However, as triathletes, we tend to look at those three athletes and go, well, if I want to be a good swim, bike, and runner, I need to do threshold sessions in swimming and biking and running every week. And lo and behold, the end result for a lot of self-coached triathletes is they're completely whipped and exhausted because they're trying to do too much threshold training in a week. So I say to my athletes, right, our aim of our run training is we're going to work on the durability of your body, the run-specific ligaments, tendons, to a certain extent, the muscles as well. You're getting pounded just by going out for a run. That effect of gravity, having your body hit the ground with repeated foot strikes. We need to build that ability to train before we can train you. And your cardiovascular system is getting that threshold workout twice a week or even three times a week on the bike. So in cardiovascular terms, you don't need to be doing threshold work in the winter in running. You just need to be getting your body to the point where you can do lots of running without picking up injuries. And that's the number one goal. And so athletes get to the end of the winter, they do the first running race, and often they're really surprised that despite having done no fast running in the winter, they do a run PB in the first run back at the end of the winter because they're so much fitter cardiovascularly because of the bike training, and they haven't picked up an injury because of the plenty of steady running that they've done. So that's often an eye-opener to people. The thing they think is going to make them faster at running isn't actually the thing that makes them faster at running. The key for improving your running is repeated running three or four times a week without getting injured. And the number one danger for getting injured is trying to run fast and hard, especially during the winter.
So that would be like three or four runs of how long? And when you say steady running, it's just, it's normally easy endurance miles, or is there a certain...
Exactly that. Yeah, we don't overthink it. I'm a big fan of using the Jack Daniels pace tables. If people have seen that, then it's his e-pace running. If you haven't seen that, it would be what would be classed as sort of low to middle zone two heart rate type running. So you're not going fast at all, but your body doesn't pick up any injuries because of that. You're not putting any stress on the, if you like, on the chassis of your body. And so you just absorb that volume really nicely.
And how long would those 3 to 4 runs per week be?
Initially, during the winter phase, we're going to focus on runs of around 30 to 45 minutes. We'll have a longer run a week that starts at, say, 45 minutes, and it'll build in duration across that sort of 18-week winter block to get to the point our athletes are running a long run of about 90 minutes. But again, we look at the best way we can use that training time. It's often not doing tons of long runs during the winter. Running short and more frequently, I think, is better for athletes than doing just one or two longer runs during the winter.
Mm. And then the swimming, you've already alluded to sort of what you're doing and what you're not doing and how much you're not doing. But if you bring that up and clarify exactly what the winter swim training might look like.
So winter swim training for me, I tend to keep guys, if they're really limited on time, they probably won't do very much swimming at all. So I won't have them in the pool three or four times a week if they're really time limited. I'll say to them, look, we can maintain your swim on maybe even one swim a week. And the swimming that you're doing, let's have you focus on really focused drill work and on building fitness as a byproduct of practicing perfect form. So again, in a perfect world, if my athletes got loads of time, yeah, they're going to go down and they're going to swim three times a week. But for most of my athletes, we look at how they can spend their, you know, their maybe 7 hours of training a week. If they can get to the pool once a week during this winter phase, then great. They're going to maintain the swim biomechanics during the winter. And then we'll look at adding more swimming in as we go towards the goal race time.
Hmm. So, moving into the spring then, how do things change in the three disciplines?
All right. So as we get into springtime on the bike, hopefully we've got to the point where we've raised our functional threshold over the winter. So we'll have done 2 9-week blocks in an ideal world. We tend to see a sort of 6 to 8% bump in FTP in each block for the majority of athletes. Now, some athletes might see more than that if they're new to sport. Most athletes are somewhere in that 6 to 8% range. So I think that's a key thing. We need to make sure that athletes are not, I mean, we've all seen these things on the internet where you go, hey, you're going to have a 25% increase in your FTP over the winter. And that'd be lovely if we could go out and all have that. And occasionally I have seen athletes who've had that, but they tend to be guys who are very new to the training. If you can get two jumps of 6 to 8% over two blocks, then you're coming out of the winter with a really nice improved FTP of maybe 15% higher than it was when you went in. So now as we go into spring, we're going faster for the same effort. We're going to reduce the amount of intensity we're doing on the bike. So typically one of our sessions a week is now going to be done at what's, you know, typically termed sweet spot. So that kind of 90% of FTP, give or take. So we can do longer reps at 90% than we could at 100, and we can do more overall work at 90% than we could at 100, but you're still probably getting probably 95% of the benefit that you were at 100%. So it's much less stressful on your body, but you can do more overall work there. That's going to help kind of push your FTP up from underneath rather than pull it up from above, if you like. Then the other thing we're going to do now is we're going to start working on specific leg strength. So we'll do some big gear work on the bike. So there's a couple of warnings here, which I'll come back to. But in general, if our athletes are healthy and they've got no knee problems, we're going to start doing, so by low cadence, I'm looking at 20 revs a minute lower than what they would consider to be their comfortable cadence. We'll start with very simply a rep of a minute of low cadence work. Say minute out of every three, pushing a big gear. We'll move to 2 minutes out of every five, 3 minutes out of every five, 5 minutes out of every 10. So the athlete gets used to this idea of pushing a bigger gear. And if they can ride outdoors this time of year, great. This makes a great session to do outdoors. Equally, it works well on the turbo. It works great outdoors if you're on sort of rolling hills and you can do the bigger gear work. Essentially, it mimics what you would do if you're riding outdoors and you're on rolling terrain. Naturally, most athletes' cadence tends to drop a bit as they're going over these rollers. So we're simulating that if athletes are indoors, and it's really good at building specific leg strength. And again, we're going to start increasing the duration slightly of those longer rides that they'll do as we're in the spring phase.
And what would the intensity of those low cadence repetitions or low cadence workouts in general be? Would that also be around sweet spot, or is it less prescribed and more free form?
I tend to have them do it actually more in zone two. So the benefit that you see with the leg strength can come at relatively quite a low intensity. And it's something that our athletes have got to learn to do, because if you say to anybody, here's an interval of 3 minutes, they go, right, I must push hard. But we try and avoid that and say, it's okay to do this in zone two heart rate, but pushing a bigger gear. And some athletes really find that difficult. You know, power tends to spike the minute we go to a lower cadence. So it's interesting for athletes to try and learn to push that bigger gear with higher muscular force, if you like, without necessarily having to push at a sweet spot percentage. And again, we can start at lower percentages of intensity. And as the season gets closer, we can start to push slightly higher intensities with the athletes that it's more specific for.
Okay. So the run and the swim done.
Yeah, with run, what we're looking at here is now we've got to the point our body is nice and durable. We can, you know, we've got this big benefit from the increased aerobic performance from the bike training over the winter. We can start to add more duration into our runs now because we're confident we can absorb those without getting injured. And we also can start to introduce a little bit more intensity. So for 70.3 athletes, this is where we're going to start doing some progressive runs, building to kind of 70.3 goal race pace, which at this point in the year is probably going to be quite challenging still in, you know, in training on your own, certainly. With my Ironman athletes, I like to say to athletes, look, let's bear in mind that you don't necessarily have to run that much faster than your goal race pace in training. And for most athletes, goal race pace in an Ironman isn't that fast. And the challenge is that they'll say to you, you know, let's take a good standard age grouper who's looking at performing pretty well in his age group, and he's looking at running, say, let's say a 3-hour 15 marathon off the bike, which in most age groups is going to be pretty competitive. That's still only 7.5 minute miles. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And a lot of athletes will kind of look at you and go, well, I think I need to be running faster than that. Actually, no, that isn't specific to how you're going to race on race day. So why use your valuable training beans in the wrong way in training? Let's have you be really specific and use the intensity in the most intelligent way.
So you're basically banking still a lot on the bike and doing more of the intensity on the bike and not putting it on the run.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in an ideal world, I want my athlete to think, if I've got more run training in me, I'd rather do it in terms of more volume than in terms of more intensity, because we want to program our bodies to be able to run comfortably at, you know, let's say that goal was 7.5 minute miles for our really good age grouper. For a lot of our athletes, it's going to be a goal of, you know, to run a 3:30 marathon in an Ironman it doesn't sound hard on practice, and pretty much everybody goes, yeah, I think I'm going to be able to do that. As anybody who's tried to do it, it's not hard for the first half of the marathon. It can get really challenging for the back half of the Ironman marathon. So what we want to be doing to them is challenging them in the right way in training to be able to hold that pace, rather than having them doing, you know, much harder running in training that isn't really going to be that specific for their goal race distance.
Yeah, and for most athletes that are not at the top end of the age group, it's zone two that they're going to be running at, and maybe the top age groupers would be at low zone three or something like that. But it's totally. Yeah, you're right, it's not very intense.
I'll give you an example from my own competitive career. Back in the day, 2008, I raced at the World Championships at ITU distance, the long distance race that was in Almere in Holland, and long story short, did what a lot of guys do. You get in a competitive race. I went far too hard on the bike, blew myself to bits, got onto the run, and I was really struggling to run 8 minute miles. And I was running next to an American guy who looked super, super fit. I've got a photograph of us running side by side, and the pair of us are, you know, like that kind of peak fitness, really ripped. We look great, but we're struggling to run 8 minute miles. And he said to me, dude, I've never run this slow in training. And that was like a light bulb moment to me, which was like a lot of people at the time, I was going out and doing tempo runs at sub 6 minute miles. And then come race day, I couldn't get anywhere near that kind of speed, partly because I'd blown myself apart on the bike. But even the guys who were the fastest in my age group, this was like a 30K run. And I think the fastest run was 2:15, say. So 45 minute 10Ks back to back, less than, not even 7 minute miling pace. And I'd been training much, much faster than that. And it made me think, why have I been training in a way to go much faster than I'm going to actually go on race day? Because most of us are not going to be doing that. So I could have used that training intensity much more intelligently in training, worked harder on the bike and got my bike fitness up. And then maybe I wouldn't have blown myself to bits on the bike.
I think this is very interesting. And but playing the devil's advocate here, because it's quite different from what I do in terms of run training and what I coach.
Yeah.
So what? Why do you think that it's not beneficial to, for example, train to increase your running threshold or your running VO2 max, and then you will be able to keep those lower intensities more comfortably because you have increased the ceiling, basically, of what you can achieve?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. If we take a step back and we look at the bigger picture, I think my approach has always been to look at the body as a whole and go aerobically and cardiovascularly, our VO2 max and our threshold is getting lifted by all the training that we're doing, whether it's swim, bike, or run. It all affects that central system. So if I've raised my threshold by training on the bike, I'm also going to have raised that threshold in terms of my body's ability to, you know, a simple terms, to buffer lactate. I'm going to have done that by very hard training on the bike. And I absolutely agree. You can skin the cat lots of different ways, and you can have your athlete go out and do lots of fast running. And that will also have the effect of either raising VO2 max or raising threshold. But my worry is always, are we increasing their susceptibility to injury and illness? And with our athletes that are bomb-proof, there's no problem with them doing that. But with a lot of the athletes I've worked with over the years, the limiting factor has not been their ability to do that, or their, not been their desire to do the work. It's been their ability to absorb the work and not get injured. So I think the safest way to do it is to have them do the work on the bike, where there's a much more minimized risk of injury. And then that the running training can then become much more about specific training of ligaments, tendons, durability to absorb volume without injury.
Sure. No, that's a really good explanation of the approach, and definitely very interesting, and something that I can see how it makes sense and how it works so well for the athletes that you coach, definitely. And
it's great to debate this, isn't it? Because there are so many different ways of training people, and lots of them are very effective. I think the key thing to being an effective coach is finding the way that works for the athlete that you're working with, and giving them confidence that what you're doing with them is going to help them in the long term.
Absolutely. There are so many different ways. And like I recently remember having some conversations with some listeners on the podcast about how they had been training a lot really based on VO2 max and quite low volume training, but a lot of VO2 max work on both the bike and the run and also the swim. I think I don't remember specifically about the swim, but that is also on the other end of the spectrum, quite a kind of an extreme way of training, not necessarily extreme, but a very different way of training. But they had seen great results from that, and they also had very good explanations for why it works. And but as you say, it depends on. That is definitely something that somebody who is susceptible to injuries might not do very well on. And I know personally, even though I might not get injured, I would get overtrained on that type of training because I really don't do well with that zone 5 work, although I can do really well with a lot of threshold work and tempo zone 3 work on both the bike and the run. So there's a big spectrum and a lot of points along that spectrum that might work.
Totally, yeah. And what I'd say to the listeners is experiment on yourselves and find out what works for you, because there are some athletes, I've interviewed Joe Skipper, for example, on the podcast a few times, and Joe is an athlete who is definitely an outlier because he can go and do threshold training in pretty much every sport, pretty much every day, and bounce back from it day to day. And I think that's just unbelievable from the context of the athletes I've worked with. Most of them, if they come down to, you know, a running track session and they do a 30-minute main set of threshold running, say they do that 5 reps of 6 minutes on the track at threshold, that's got a great effect on the cardiovascular system. But the next day they wake up really sore, and they have to have a day off running, and secondly they have to have an easy day of cycling because their muscles are really sore from it. Whereas if they do that same session on the bike, you can make the argument that on the cardiovascular system they've had the same training stimulus. But most people get up the day after a threshold training session on the bike and they feel completely fine to train again. So it's also, I think, looking at what allows you to get the most training done in a week relative to the time you've got. And another thing, Michael, I'm 46 this year. The amount of running that I can do that's hard these days compared to 15 years ago, it breaks my heart. I only have to arrive at the gates of a running track these days to get sore. So that's a big eye-opener for me, is that when we're coaching aging athletes, when we get into the 40s, we really have to be aware that not everybody can absorb sessions in the same way. And it's definitely something I was guilty of in my younger days of coaching when I was, you know, my early 30s. I'd be coaching guys in the mid 40s, and it took me a while to realize they don't feel the same as I do the day after this session, you know? So it's giving the appropriate training to the appropriate athlete at the right time as well, I think.
Yeah, that example with Joe Skipper is so interesting, because I think that especially in long distance racing, that when we talk about genetically gifted athletes, I don't think it's that you need to have a predisposition for a high VO2 max or anything like that. It's you need to be genetically gifted in how well you recover and bounce back for sessions and do a lot of hard work.
Yep. Exactly. And that thing you said about like really hard training in terms of VO2 max, it can have a great effect on your fitness, but it can have a really bad effect on your immune system. So if an athlete tries to train really hard and then gets a cold or gets sick, as you alluded to with yourself, Joe just doesn't get that. He doesn't get sick. He can just bounce back time after time. Whereas with most people, it's one of those like experiment with yourself, but be honest. If it isn't working, you need to shift to something that is working, I think.
Yeah. So let's quickly talk about the swim training during spring, and then we can jump into the race prep period, the last few months before the race.
Totally. So with our swim training in the springtime, what we're looking at doing is we're now going to start making use of the fact you've got improved swim mechanics due to your technique work in the winter. We start to swim a bit more frequently, and the sessions are going to be a mix of still working on specific drills to address whatever limiters you've got, but now starting to introduce a little bit more volume and a little bit more intensity. So typically in this phase, my 1 hour sessions are going to be broken down into 20-ish minutes of specific drill practices, and then a 20 to 30 minute main set with a mix of either endurance main set or some limited threshold type training at this time of year as well. So we start to build the swim fitness by training hard as well as training our technique.
Yeah. And then the race prep period, if we go through the disciplines in that phase, let's call it the last 2 months or so before the race, or whatever period you want to go with.
Yeah, so typically my in inverted commas race prep phase will be about 12 weeks long. And what we'll do with the athletes here is we say, okay, and we're talking, I'm going to be clear here, we're talking about long distance athletes racing 70.3 or Ironman. The most specific training at this time of year is to get them used to the big challenge of race day. And the big challenge is how long they're going to be out there for, especially for our iron distance racers. The actual pace they're going to hold on race day isn't really the challenge for them, because for most people, if you get them to go out and ride at Ironman intensity or run Ironman intensity or even swim at Ironman intensity relative to what they're honestly going to do on race day, that intensity is not going to be that challenging for them. It's their ability to do that for the duration of time. So now is the point where I'm going to say to people, look, I've been talking about smart use of time all the way through our training plans. This is a time you're now honestly going to have to carve some more time out of your week, because the way you're going to prepare for your long distance races is training with longer volumes. So in all of our efforts now, we're going to be building the duration to get closer to the time we're going to be training for on race day. And the intensity is going to more closely match the time that you're going on race day. So I'm still going to have them do one sweet spot session a week on the bike to try and sort of increase that top end power, or at least hold that top end power there. But the rest of it, the intensities are going to drop down to be more like they'll do on Ironman race day. Again, for 70.3 athletes, we'll have them do some intervals that will more specifically mimic their 70.3 race distance. But the key thing that I'm going to do with my athletes during this race preparation phase is we're going to do one or maybe two race preparation weekends where they're going to do a broken, if you like, a broken Ironman or a broken half Ironman across a weekend. So long swim Friday night, long bike ride followed with a run off the bike on Saturday, long run very first thing Sunday morning. So what you're trying to do here is you're trying to mimic the demands of race day. So most people can carve out the time just a couple of times to go away and do a really long swim Friday night for our Ironman distance races. So they're going to do 4.5K in the pool. Then they're going to get up. They're going to ride 6 hours on the bike, and then straight away they're going to run 45 minutes off the bike. Then they're going to recover for the rest of the day. And then first thing Sunday morning, they're going to get out and do the long run. So again, for the Ironman distance races, they're going to run for 2 hours, very first thing Sunday morning. And with that, they're going to have covered pretty much the entire Ironman duration over what's not much more than about a 30-hour period. So if we time that workout correctly, and we've got the training right in the lead up to that, that's going to give our athletes a really good sense of how fast they can realistically go on the bike on race day. Because, you know, most people are really bad at judging that, and they'll go out on what feels easy, but it's much too hard. And trying to do a 6 hour Ironman paced ride, the last 2 hours of that are a really good guide as to whether you've actually gone at a pace that's achievable on race day or not.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. So makes sense. And in that, outside of those long weekends, like how long would your athletes train on the weekends, for example, when you probably have the long sessions on a more normal weekend in this last period?
Well, we're gonna build up to the point where the long ride is going to be 6 hours. It might be a little bit shorter than that for our faster athletes and make it a bit more specific. So if they're, you know, expecting to do a 4:45 bike leg, the ride might be a bit shorter than that. But oftentimes I'll have them do a longer ride anyway, because, you know, let's not mix messages here. They're going to be out there on race day for, you know, let's say 9 hours for our fastest athletes, 10 hours, 11 hours, 14 hours, 15 hours. We need them to get used to training for an extended period of time. So the long ride is going to go to about 6 hours. The long run will go to a maximum of 2 hours, 45, maybe 3 hours for some athletes. But again, what I find is it's better for athletes to do several weeks of a repeated 2.5 hour run rather than trying to do 1 3.5 hour run and be completely wrecked for 3 or 4 days afterwards. So we're always trying to train with the next day in mind. And one tip I'll give athletes here is I only ever have my athletes do their long run the day after the long bike on those specific race preparation weekends, because the rest of the time I actually like to split those up. So they'll do the long ride on Saturday and they'll do the long ride on a Wednesday or a Thursday. So they're doing the long run on fresh legs, again, thinking about minimizing injury risk, and then they're going to do the long ride at the weekend when they've got more time.
Yeah, I think that's a really smart approach. I really like that that idea, definitely. And
it's hard, isn't it, man? And we've all done those hell weekends where you've tried to do like 6 hour ride Saturday, 3 hour run Sunday, and by Sunday lunchtime you're lying on the sofa wondering what day it is because you're so completely wrecked, and it takes the rest of the week to recover. So that's my overall guiding principle here with the time training system, is we're trying to train in a way that you can train again the next day. You're never putting yourself into a massive hole where you're completely wrecked.
Yeah, totally. I think I have an episode on this. It might be in one of my beginner tip episodes, actually, where I talk about the concept of optimizing for the whole week or the whole mesocycle, yeah, rather than optimizing for single workouts. And you don't want to, it depends on what type of athlete you are and what race you're training for, but especially for long distance racing, you very rarely should do like best effort workouts. You should get the job done, but you should feel that you have something left in the tank so that you can still go out and do the work the next day.
Couldn't agree more. Most athletes tend to underestimate what they can do in a week and overestimate what they can do in a day. And it's that repeated, no one's going to get good at Ironman in 3 months. You know what I mean? It's a repeated process of enjoying what you do day after day and never getting yourself sick, ill, or injured.
Yeah. So if we talk a bit about the winter, because that's the period we're heading into, and we start wrap this discussion up with an example week, a typical week for a 70.3 or Ironman age grouper, as they are, let's say, in the middle of the winter period, not the very beginning, not the very end. So what would a typical week look like in terms of how many hours, how many workouts per discipline, etc.?
Yeah, got you. Okay, so what we'll typically do is we'll sketch a week out and we'll say, I'll kick off with Monday being a rest and recovery day, because I think at the end of the week, the most important thing is to make sure we're recovered. So plan that in first. Completely rest and recovery focused day. So there's two ways to approach that. If you're the kind of swimmer that is a relatively decent swimmer and you can do a recovery swim and feel better at the end of it, go and do that. It's like a free massage. If you're a beginner swimmer and any kind of swim workout is a real hard effort for you, stay out of the water. So focus on doing what you need to do to recover. And then typically we'll do our threshold workouts on the bike on Tuesday and Thursday. And then we'll do a longer ride on Saturday. That's ideally we're going to go outdoors and ride for up to 3 hours. If not, I'll give them a 90-minute turbo session indoors that's going to include some sweet spot work. So that's the biking covered. That's Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. We'll then have them do steady runs Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. So again, early winter, it might be 2 runs of 30 minutes and a 45-minute long run. And we'll build to 2 runs of 45 minutes and a 90-minute long run. And then we'll schedule our key swim for the week on that Wednesday, probably, so that they'll do a mix of, you know, real technique-focused work and then maybe a little bit of quality swimming as we progress through the winter. If they've then got more time, we'll add in an endurance-based swim on the Friday as well. So that gives us a total week that looks like Monday is a recovery day with maybe a recovery swim. Tuesday and Thursday as bike-focused days. Wednesday, you've got that swim and run. Fridays, you've got a run and maybe an additional swim. Saturdays, longer bike. Sundays, longer run.
And how many hours in total would that be roughly?
That'll work out at about 7 hours a week for most athletes across the winter. Depending on how long the duration of that long ride is outdoors, it's going to be anywhere from the sort of 5.5 to 8 hour range.
Okay, got it. So one thing that I meant to ask with the swimming and the technique focus in the winter, actually, is how do you recommend that? Because I think many age groupers, especially more beginner swimmers, they know that they need to work on technique, but they have no idea how to do it. They might watch some random drills on YouTube and do them, but they don't know why they're doing them and probably do them incorrectly and maybe not get the benefits that they should from that technique work. So
yeah,
in some ways, I think you almost need to be an advanced swimmer to get a lot of benefit from doing a lot of technique work. But it depends on the mindset that you bring into the swim sessions as well, because I do have some beginner athletes that have a great attitude and are really focused, but it really varies. So what's your recommendations for age groupers to get the most out of technique training? How do you work that into the programs of the athletes you coach?
I'll tell you what, man, we could spend the whole interview on this, couldn't we? You're dead right. It's a hard one for people to improve the swimming without some specific guidance. And so my first thing is, if you can find a club that's got a good swim coach and who can watch your swim, go and do that. Just get a bit of feedback from somebody. If you can have underwater swim analysis done, have somebody do that for you. Even if it's just your friend filming you and you look at what you're actually doing rather than what you think you're doing, you can then compare that to the perfect model and see what changes you need to make. But now listen, I've got no affiliation with this company other than thinking they're fantastic, but if people haven't checked out the stuff that's available for free at swimsmooth.com,
yes,
Paul there is just, he's got such a great program, and like they provide the coach education stuff that we teach for British Triathlon coach education. He's got a set of specific drills that if people cycle through them, they're going to feel immediately whether this drill is going to help them. Things like the fist drill, the 6-3-6 drill, especially the Unco drill is my favorite, although everyone hates it. That will really help athletes break down their stroke and see what they need to improve. But in general, what I say to people is, if you do one length of drill and one length of swim, if you're not feeling like something's improving in your swimming, you need to get the help of a professional who can look at you and tell you exactly what the drill is that's going to help take you through that plateau.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's something that everybody should do, really. But also, I'm totally a fan of Swim Smooth. I'm a paying customer of the Swim Smooth Guru platform.
Oh, it's awesome, so, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I highly recommend it to anybody, whether you have that swim coach or an overall triathlon coach or not. It's really great, really good explanations of the drills, why you do them, how you should do them. Great videos, great quality.
Yeah, really, really impressive.
Final question before we move into the rapid fire questions. Do you have any other tips that we haven't talked about yet for helping the age group athletes that listen to this episode be more time efficient with their training?
I think the key is, I'm going to come back to saying again, the thing you want to do is to train as often as you can without getting injured. And that's the key, without getting injured. If you can avoid picking up an injury and getting sick, you're doing a really good job. And 90% of the benefit is going to come from just getting out there and doing the training and not getting in your own way. So if you tend to go a bit slower rather than a bit harder, that's going to mean you're probably going to have more success in the long term. If you then do your intensity stuff intelligently and you monitor those improvements as you go along, that's going to give you the biggest overall bang for your buck.
Brilliant. All right, so then the rapid fire questions that you know very well by now, having listened to the show.
Let's
start with, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to triathlon?
It's going to go back a few years, this one, but Gordo Burns stuff. Gordo kept a weekly blog, and a lot of listeners probably won't know him. Gordo was an age grouper who very quickly got really good at Ironman, and back in the early 2000s finished second overall Ironman Canada, and he kept an overall blog weekly of what he did to go from, I don't know, he was like a mid 12 hours Ironman guy when he did his first one, to get down to 8:30 at Ironman Canada. And I just loved reading his blog every week, and I still go back. I wish he'd pull it together into a book, because it would make the greatest story. And he's got a book as well called Going Long, which I've read from cover to cover about 100 times. So that's my favorite stuff. I'm a big fan of his.
Great. Yeah, I have that book as well, but I haven't checked out his blog. I know his story, but he was a bit before my triathlon time. So I need to look those things up. It sounds very interesting.
He's awesome, man. Yeah.
What's your favorite piece of gear or equipment?
My running shoes, no question. I think as I get older, I get the most benefit. I mean, we've talked all this stuff about training and performance. It's easy to lose sight of the fact that we do this because we enjoy moving in nature. And that's what it's all about for me. Get the running shoes on and go out and run through the forest.
And what running shoes do you have? Do you have any particular preference as for what brand and model?
Do you know, it's just the Salomon Speedcross Varios at the moment. I stumbled across those, a mate of mine, Matt Rushbrook, put me onto them, and they're super comfy. And love them.
And finally, who's somebody in triathlon that you look up to?
As well as having mentioned Gordo, who's moved out of coaching so much these days, I'm a really big fan of the guys at Swim Smooth. Paul Newsome, I went on one of his swim coach education courses many, many years ago. And to this day, it was one of the most profoundly affecting courses I've been on. I think he's a fantastic example of someone who can get information across to people really simply, information that might be really complicated. He can put it across in a really simple way. And I think they're a great company.
Yeah, I agree. And we'll link to the episodes. I have a two-part interview with Paul Newsome, episode 132 and 33, I think it is. So I'll link to that in the show notes so that listeners can go and listen to that. It's well worth a listen.
Yeah. Superb guy.
All right. Thank you so much, Rob. It was really great to have you on and talk about the time effective training. And tell the listeners where they can find out more about you, your coaching, and your podcast, everything you got going on.
Yeah, so it'd be great if you pop on over to oxygenaddict.com. We've got a weekly triathlon podcast that's got a slightly different focus to yours. We tend to do more interviews on pros and racers and people like that. So it's a nice contrast to the information that you give out on your great show. And you can also check out Team Oxygen Addict, which is obviously, I spent many years coaching people on a one-to-one basis. Team Oxygen Addict is like a group coaching environment where we've got a whole bunch of pre-written training plans, but we try and stream people as they come in so they get the training plan that's appropriate to them. And my sort of catchphrase with that is 99% of the benefit of one-to-one coaching at about half the price. So hopefully we've got something there for anybody who's looking to get themselves into the coaching arena.
Brilliant. And that will also be linked to in the show notes and the episode description so that the listeners can find it. All right.
Thanks, man.
Thank you so much, Rob. It was great having you on, and have a great rest of your day.
And listen, I just want to say thank you to you for having me on. I've loved listening to your show over the years, and I think you do a great job. And like I said, it's been a great honor to be invited on, and I hope it's been helpful to listeners.
I think so. Thank you so much for the kind words. Bye.
Thank you, mate.
Hope that you enjoyed that interview, and we discussed a lot of details and specifics, which is great. I really like it when my guests provide weekly plans, etc., like Rob did. And especially we went into detail with the winter training and how Rob structures the winter training for his athletes. So I think it's definitely worth going back and listening to this again and making sure that you get those details. But the one main takeaway that I want to leave you with today, you actually already heard in the outtake from today's episode, and that is to avoid getting injured and avoid getting sick at all costs. It's a different way of saying consistency, that old boring thing that you hear time and time again, but it is so important. And this is something that I want to pull together some data, some stats, and try to quantify how important that consistency is from the athletes that I coach. If I do, when I do, I might share my findings in an episode. So, but we'll see. That's still on the to-do list. But anyway, that is my main takeaway. Avoid getting injured and avoid getting sick. You can find the show notes from today's episode on thattriathlonshow.com. And if you have questions or comments, please leave them there in the comment section. I get too much email already, so I cannot answer email on specific episodes individually. I want to answer them so that everybody can read them on those comment sections. And your question might already be answered if you had any question, if you go and look at those comment sections. Do check out the Oxygen Addict podcast and the website. All of it will be linked to in the show notes. There are plenty of really good content on the podcast. And if you're interested in the coaching, check out Team Oxygen Addict as well. In the next episode, I will interview Cyril Schmidt, PhD, who you actually heard last episode where he talked about, no, two episodes ago, where he talked about his training platform, Gutai. And in the next episode, we will talk about non-functional overreaching, which is one of the topics that Cyril investigated in his PhD. And it is a topic close to my heart because I've suffered from it on a couple of occasions pretty severely this season, actually. And I will talk about my personal experience with this as well. So look forward to that. Stay subscribed. If you are new to the podcast especially, make sure that you are subscribed so that you get all the new episodes as they are released. But also go back and check out all the archives. Again, you can find them in your podcast app or on thattriathlonshow.com. Just click through to see all podcast episodes and listen to all the gems from way back when that you find interesting. Some of the most popular ones that I would recommend are the interviews with Paul Newsome from Swim's Move, and the one with Carlson Kristen from Tri Sado, and Matt Fitzgerald's The Endurance Diet episode. Those are all in the top most downloaded episodes that I have, so definitely recommend checking those out. If you have been listening for a while, please help me grow the podcast by telling your friends, telling your teammates, your coach, your athletes, anybody that might be interested about it. It really is a massive help whenever you do that, even if you just get one person to listen to one episode. Finally, big thanks to Stack for helping keep this podcast going. You can find Stack on stackzero.com. That's S-T-A-C, zero spelled out, .com. And they make the world's quietest indoor bike trainers with no wear and tear on the bike, the tire of the bike, because they use magnets instead of resistance flywheels. It folds really nicely. You can store it under your bed, which is what I do because I live in a small room and not in a big apartment. So it has many, many great features and benefits. So do check it out. They have three different models with different levels of features and different price points. So there's a model for everybody there. And of course, take 20% off your order with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps. And big thank you to Roka, now with UK and EU distribution. Check them out on roka.com and take 20% off your entire order with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.